Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black Arts and Culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. We are joined in the studio by Kwame Thompson, who is going to be, or Thomas, I should say, who is going to be telling us about a gig tomorrow at the 57th Street Gallery in Oakland. So I know you hope you're in Oakland, California for Saturday night, November 23rd, for a phenomenal concert featuring Kwame Thomas. Good morning, Kwame. Thanks for hanging in there.
Hey, Wanda, how are you?
Oh, I am doing really well. I was like running, literally running, because I had to broadcast from work.
Yeah, so was the wind, wasn't it?
Oh, my goodness. Wasn't the wind phenomenal? Like, I was seriously cutting up last night.
I'm really happy about that because it just blows all this stuff away. The rain came, then the wind came.
Yeah. And since you're an African, continental African sister, you're like closer to the spirituality of those things, you know, so you want to tell us a little bit about what that might symbolize or anything?
I personally think, and most people would agree, that after all this dry time that we've had, this rain has come to bless us and bless the soil and clean all the air of all the muck that's accumulated. And if that wasn't enough, the rain comes right behind it and blows the wind comes right behind it and blows the whatever's left behind away. I'm taking it as a good omen for tomorrow night.
Yeah, definitely. It's so beautiful. I mean, I'm thinking, wow, it's really unfortunate I have to be stuck inside all day today. Can't enjoy this wonderful fresh air, which smells so good.
Mm. Well, don't feel too bad.
Are you going to be stuck inside too, or no?
I will be, yes, for at least half of the day, excuse me, because I have to go do my job that pays the bills. So I'm definitely going to be inside for a while too, and then I'm going to escape, get myself ready for tomorrow.
Okay. Yeah, well, tell us about your gig tomorrow night with the ensemble and you're being a featured guest. Tell us about the gig and because you performed with them before. This is not your first time, but this time you're going to sing more because the audience just loved you so much.
That's what I heard from last year's experience. Melvin Butts, in his wisdom, has decided that I should speak more. And Melvin Butts is the saxophone player. He plays his alto sax, and he's the one who's put the ensemble together. We performed together last year. He asked me to join them to do the show at 57th Street Gallery, which, by the way, is a wonderful environment to be in, to be performing, and also to be in the audience. And so he gathered together some of the most strongest players that I know of in the Bay Area, that he knows of in the Bay Area, and we came together and literally had one heck of a time in the place. I hadn't seen such a large group on the stage before. Normally they have trios and quartets and quintets and so on. But here we are, eight of us on that stage, and we're blowing we're blowing the roof off the rafters, and people are having such great fun. And there were, I heard, at least three standing ovations, which doesn't happen that often in the place. So I'm happy about that, and I'm ready to just kick it up quite a few notches tomorrow.
I was just looking at this beautiful photograph of you and the ensemble. And I recognize some of the names. Leon Joyce on drums. You got two drummers, Leon Joyce, Greg German, and then Melvin Butts, of course, on saxophones, and you got Keith Saunders on piano and Gigi Taylor on trumpet.
Denny Armstrong on trombone. Now that was last year's lineup.
And I have to
make a correction here because Leon Joyce wasn't able to play last year, and he's not able to play this year either. He has to be out of town.
Okay.
And so Greg German filled in for him admirably. This year's lineup, I know for sure that Keith Saunders is going to be there. That's a, he's a wonderful keyboard. Oh, my goodness. Very mellifluous in his playing. And, of course, Melvin Butts and myself, I'll be there. Yours truly, Hashima, will be on bass. And let's see, Greg German will be on drums, and then Butch will be on a percussion. I'm not sure of the other two horn players who will be coming in, but Mel has arranged all of that. I'm confident in that, and we'll be there. And I hope you'll be there, and everybody.
yeah. Well, you know, I already committed. I'm coming. I'm going to come through there and then, you know, head on over to Ashkenaz for Julia's group. They're going to be performing and doing a fundraiser for Zimbabwe. But I was just thinking about Gigi. He actually is performing in San Francisco at Marco Hall's Bebop Baby, and that starts at 8 o'clock, too. So
Gigi
maybe
Taylor?
He's not going to be. Yeah, he's playing drums.
Oh, no, he can't be there.
So he can't be there, so I guess he's going to be there in spirit.
No, the only home player that I know who will be there is Mel so far, because he put it together. But no, the other two horn players, they said they could, but then of course that was way back, and things happen, and so no, Geechee won't be there, and Danny won't be there either. He's also out of town. It's that time of year, you know, with Thanksgiving and everything else. So everything is we set it up. And I got the flyer together. In fact, I used a picture from last year just to have something visual. But as for the names and things, what do they say? The best laid plans of mice and men. So we set it up and asked the folks and things changed, you know. And you have to be as flexible. And if you as a jazz performer, you have to be rather pliable in that sense and be free with whatever changes come. So here it is. And so the lineup, as you see it, is not quite the same, but we're going to give you what you came for and then some.
right. Yeah. So you're going to be performing from 8:30 p.m. to 11 p.m. and the doors open at 5. And you can make reservations for tables 1 to 8, and it's first come, first serve, otherwise.
Yes.
And since 7th Street Gallery is actually on 57th Avenue
and Telegraph,
and the address is 5701 Telegraph Avenue. Can't miss it. It's right. It's very, very, it has a presence on the
corner.
Yes,
you really can't miss
it. Yeah. And the phone number there is 510-654-6974. And the prices are always pretty affordable. What is it, like $15 or something?
It's $15, and they have wine too, so you can come you come and relax and have some of your favorite wine and enjoy the music and the artwork and the ambiance and the audience and the friends and the music and it's quite an evening. A lot happens in that place. On Monday nights they have the jam session, and then Thursdays they have another jam session, and weekends they have featured artists. So,
I'm excited too. Yeah, I was just looking at how you've traveled quite widely. You lived in Africa where you were born, and then from there, I believe you went to England. But then you've also lived in Germany and Paris and Hawaii, where you taught a little bit, and Japan, and now you're here in America. And I was noticing how you arrived in England. You didn't speak any English, but you read the dictionary to study the language, and then you won all these prizes. You must have did really well, spelling bees and educational.
When you arrive somewhere and you don't speak the language, it's not a funny thing at all. And I arrived at the age of 10 and didn't know a word except yes and no. And the story, my story, what happened exactly briefly is that I went to school within about a week of arriving in England. And there I was in class, not speaking English, and someone asked me, "What's your name?" And I said, yes, because that's the only word, the only two words I knew were yes and no. I said, yes. Mm-hmm. Of course, they laughed and they laughed and they laughed. And then they said, where do you live? And I said, no. So, you know, I had to learn that language real fast. And I'm mm-hmm. so glad I did, because it served me well, and I've been able to help others in teaching them English as a result. So, you know, you do what you have to do wherever you are,
mm-hmm.
whatever comes at you.
Yeah.
It's a challenge, you know.
So what is your native language, and why did your family move from Ghana to England?
I speak Ga because my father is a Ga. He's from the Akan group, and my mother is Fanti. They were not teaching English at the time to primary school children at the time, so of course I didn't learn it. But that's the language we spoke. My father worked for the Lands Department. He ended up coming to study law in England, and he brought us over, and that was 1964. And so that's mm-hmm. when we arrived from Ghana. It's hot, a bright hot day, and ended up in England in September. It was cold as hell, but anyway, that's a whole other story. And that's how my mm-hmm. life in the West started, basically, in a nutshell. And
mm-hmm.
I
yeah.
got the.
Did you all go back and did you go home and visit your family from Europe and go back home to stay in touch?
I've been going back as an adult. It took us a while. At least for me personally, it took a while before I actually got back to Ghana. I was 10 when we arrived. I think it took many, many years before I actually went back. I may have been 20 or so before I went back to Ghana again. And then since then, I've been going back and forth whenever I can, because, of course, it's expensive. Mm-hmm. The last time I was there was in February this year.
Okay.
And I'm hoping to go back, basically make a home base over there, you know.
Mm-hmm. Did your family in Ghana visit you? I mean, how did you sort of stay in touch? Because, you know, as a person, a diaspora person myself, I don't know who my family is, but you actually have family. Like, you know, you can
mm-hmm.
call them on the phone and you can talk. So how did you stay in touch with your family? Was there like a big Ghanaian community in England when you moved there, so you were able to keep your language and your customs and things like that, and your traditions, like some of the holidays and things that you all did back home, you could continue to do there? How did you maintain your sense of yourself in this environment where it was freezing cold and you didn't know the language and people, you know, weren't necessarily trying to get to know you better? You had to get to know them better and sort of transform yourself.
This is a very big question with a big answer, and I could go on and on, but let's see. How did I stay in touch? Yes, as a Ghanaian in England, as a child growing up there and having to learn everything about the place in order to fit in, because we weren't going back to Ghana, that was for sure. It was a culture shock to start with, but we had to survive. At least I'll just speak for myself. I had to survive to go to school. I had to learn the language. I had to make friends. And I did all of that growing up, 15, 16, 17, and then I started work and stayed in touch as much as possible with Ghanaians. My father's friends used to come by, and, of course, knowing them helped. And then, of course, I'd made friends in the community and hung out with them. And, yes, we did do some of the cultural things. My mother also. So as much as possible, we learned and associated with friends of my parents, and then through them, their children. And then as a teenager and growing older, I met my own friends, and that way we stayed close to the roots, so to speak. My mother always spoke Ga to us in the house. So did my father, as much as possible. But he said, while we're in England now, we had to learn to be somewhat like the English and learn the language and learn the nuances of what goes on in the land, basically. So we immersed ourselves as much as possible. I am a proud African. I have to say that because coming over, because of the culture shock and then learning the history and knowing, feeling some of the ways we were negatively treated and all of that, I learned I had to stand up. I had to represent. I had to be who I was and couldn't be anything else anyway because it didn't serve me. So as I've grown up and as I've traveled and as I've come into the world, especially into America and learning the history of America and all of that, it makes me feel very proud to be who I am and knowing my people back in Ghana. Because, as you said, you can trace your people, but you could never find the person who you directly came from. So knowing all of that, I feel a sense of showing who I am and being a strong person, a human person, an African person as I am, being able to relate with everyone else, but knowing who I am and being identifying myself who I am in this world on any stage and being sure of myself, because how else can I be anybody else? The world has taught me to be who I am and stand up and be strong in who I am and represent, because everyone else does for themselves. And so I should do the same for me as well. And the, let's see, considering all the people in the world and all the different peoples in the world, we have to, our differences make a difference. And our differences and our sameness also is important. But it's the differences that fuses and colors and flavors and makes us all so damned interesting in this world. And so I have a duty, I feel, considering what has happened to us as a people, to really represent in the most positive way possible. And that is the short and the long of that answer, because I could go on and on and on and on.
Yeah, well, I'm
but that,
sure
you know,
must
that's
be,
it.
You know. Yeah, well, I'm sure, you know, child, I don't know if you were aware of it when you were a child, but later on, and also since you were in England, I don't know how much African history and African diaspora history was a part of the curriculum, but, you know, knowing that, you know, you are a citizen of the first independent African nation, you know, out of colonialism, and the work that Nkrumah, you know, really known for, you know, similar to Marcus Garvey insofar as, you know, the Pan-African diaspora and trying to, the first person to talk about, you know, United States of Africa philosophically, you know?
I love me some Kwame Nkrumah. It's all I can say.
Yeah.
And Marcus Garvey and all those pioneers. My goodness, what can I say? Once again, if you go back to history and see what was going on, that was the only way to go. You can't give up, can you? You shouldn't give up. This life belongs to all of us. And so we have to take care of ourselves. And like I said, whatever happens, people, you will be pushed and you will be pushed and you'll be pushed. At some point, you have to push back and get yourself up and dust yourself off and keep going. If you have that will, somebody like Kwame Nkrumah, he had traveled and he saw what was going on and he realized that we had to also do what we needed to do. We have the resources, you know, and so why not? And why tolerate nonsense from anyone else when you have your own and you can take care of your own? Unfortunately, people will come and take, and so you have to resist and negotiate as much as possible, but you have to get your own act together also. And this is what he was doing. And I really, to this day, there are still folks back there who Kwame Nkrumah, the one, because I think they call him Osagyefo Kwame Nkrumah, which believes means savior, literally, because he was getting them up and up, up and about, up and about, basically. Some of the things he did, they're still there. It's undeniable. So I love me some Kwame Nkrumah.
Yeah, I was just looking at your name, and Kwame must be the masculine form of Kwama. So did your dad and mom name you after him?
I don't think so. I don't think so. And my father apparently something untraditional with regard to naming us, because I believe my name means, as far as the days of the week, is Saturday, because I was born on Saturday. But I understand the name also means hero, Kwame, and hero, heroine or heroine, heroine. But then he did something else. So instead of naming us Kofi and Ama and that sort of thing, I believe, I'm not quite sure, he named my sister Yankuba, which is not the traditional line of from the eldest to the youngest kind of thing, and from the days of the week. So I, you know, some of the stuff is lost, but all I know is that my name means Kwama, and I mean Saturday, because I was born on Saturday, and also it means hero in.
Heroine. Yeah. Right. That's really neat. But I was just thinking, you say you love you some Kwame Nkrumah, and it's like,
I do.
Your names are, you have the same name. That's so cool.
Yeah, well, I'm not really, I can't go off of that, I'm telling you. No.
Well, you can go off, maybe your dad, not intentionally, but, you know, sort of like, you know, who knows what the ancestors were figuring out, you know?
Well, I'm telling you, if you couldn't ask for a better example as far as leaders at that time, you know? So I take my hat off to him a million and one times. That's all I can say.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, in our final minutes, I would just wanted to let our audience know that you are also a radio personality. You've had radio programs in London and New York and Hawaii, and you've toured extensively as a musician, and you performed for Jesse Jackson during his presidential campaign in Hawaii. And then you sang the American National Anthem at the first Zone 2 meeting that hosted Attorney General Kamala Harris. So that's recent, because she just became the California's first woman, and particularly you know, African woman with, you know, Indian ancestry, South Asian ancestry. So that's recent. So tell us about, you know, sort of like, you know, how you'd be working this this musical thing as you're, you know, paying your bills and teaching people how to speak English and representing as an African woman. And then, talk a little bit about the North American Bush Band. I love the name. And you all won the Best World Music CD and Best Video at the Hawaii. Hawaii must have been a really hot place for you, because you did a whole lot in Hawaii.
Hawaii was great. Hawaii was, it's the most creative period in my life, I do believe. That's where I did the radio and the teaching and the and North American Bush Band. North American Bush Band is a funk-based band from Philadelphia who were based in Hawaii at the time. And when I got there, I ended up being their lead singer for quite a while. It was great. It absolutely fantastic. I just talked to the band leader recently. He's back in he's actually in California somewhere, Southern California, and still playing. And that's where I really matured as far as a musician, because we played rock, jazz, funk, African ska, reggae, and everything else in between, all funk-based, and we had a blast. We toured from Oregon to down here to San Francisco Maritime Hall, and it was great, absolutely fantastic. I have no regrets at all. In fact, in life, I have very few regrets. I have 1, 2, or 3 regrets. That's about it. Very strong band, North American Bush Band. I'm so happy that I was associated with them, and hope to one day again, because it taught me a lot. Jazz is relatively new in my life, but I enjoy that also. I shouldn't say but. I really enjoy that also. There's a freedom in it. Oh, my goodness. Right now I'm listening to Gregory Porter. I had to listen to Dee Dee Bridgewater, Zap Mama, Aretha Franklin. You know, in order to perform jazz, I'm listening to all these different musicians so that I can get my system ready for it. And so it's going to be interesting. It's going to be very interesting. I'm going to actually attempt to do Pretty Eyes, which is by Dee Dee Bridgewater. And I'll do Round Midnight and some Nina Simone. My baby just cares for me. Then you'll hear something, the standard Summertime, and I'm going to do Malaika by one of my favorite activist musicians, Miriam Makeba. What I need is a manager in order to perform as a musician full time. It's not an easy road to travel. However, it's one heck of a blessing. And as a musician, if you enjoy it, it balances out your life. It keeps you from taking on and wearing these things that could depress you. And what can I say? I feel very, very fortunate to have done what I've done and included music in my life. And that brings me laughter and helps me to meet people like you. And we go places and enjoy ourselves. And as an individual in this world, when I think of all the places I've been and all the people I've met, my goodness, I don't think I want to exchange my life for anyone else's.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I really don't.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So when do you start singing professionally? Where'd you get your training? Because people, I always think that as African people, the arts, music and dance and instrumental music, particularly percussion music, and maybe some of the wind instruments, they're just sort of like household utensils. I mean.
Yeah.
The instruments are just around, and if they aren't, you sort of make them out of boxes and cans and the kinds of things and the voice, the human voice, black people just sing. I mean, because I'm from the South and we sang and my mother sang and then you go to the church and you're dancing for the Lord, but you're still dancing. It's just something that you don't have to like go to school for, but then you want to perfect your skills, and if you want to do this for a career. So can you talk a little bit, and I really am going to have to close out. And I want to know if you want to sing us a couple of bars of Malaika to sort of tantalize our audience,
Oh, my goodness. See, you had to go there, didn't you?
Yeah.
Okay, well, you basically answered your own question there as far as being music. It took me a while, though, to actually decide to be a musician to sing, because of course you have to be responsible in this world. But anyway, I took it on anyway and did get some training in New York. I was at Columbia University, I was at City College, I've been with several bands, and so it's all training all the way along the line. And there it is. As far as singing you a little bit, Malaika. Nakupenda malaika, malaika, nakupenda malaika, ngekuo mariwe, yet to go so far. It is such a treasure, can't be placed. Nakupenda malaika. And then it begins to tell, around midnight, I do pretty well till after sundown, and you'll have to come to the show to hear the rest.
Oh, that was certainly a great commercial. So we're speaking to Kwame Thomas.
I like the way you laugh.
Kwame Thomas is special guest tonight with the Melvin Bus Ensemble that is just all-star lineup, the the certainty there is Melvin Butts on saxophone and Kwame Thomas, and that's all you need to know, right?
The name is Thompson.
Thompson. Okay.
It is Thompson. I call myself Kwame T. And
Kwame T. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Just to make it short, and it's going to be really great. We want to bring you peace. We want to bring you blessings. We want to bring you joy. And fill you up before you go to your turkey Thanksgiving dinner, but with music to eat by when you Okay, I think I better stop because I'm getting delirious just from this this conversation we've
had. Yeah, well, this is food for the soul, and it's always really great, you know, these November events, because it sort of in America gets us ready for the season of joy and goodwill to all, and then in the midst of that, we think about, you know, the folks that are, you know, we see when we're driving down the street. I saw this dog right in the Meridian on Brush Street in West Oakland going toward the highway, and he was all bundled up, you know, with a sleeping bag, and there's some water in front of him and a backpack, but there was no owner. And I'm like, wow. But the dog, I guess he wasn't moving. He was just chilling. And I'm like, boy, I hope I hope all the cars stay in their lanes, because he was in a really dangerous spot waiting for his owner to come back. But, you know, you think about people who are homeless, people who don't have enough food, people who are not sure how they're going to pay their rent or their mortgage and having different kinds of issues with their family, you know, all during this period. And so to be able to step out of that, you know, into a place like 57th Street Gallery, which is not, like, it's in the hood. I mean, it's in, like, Oakland, in the town. I mean, you know, it's like, you can ignore what, it's like Oakland, but it's a beautiful oasis that
it really is
created here.
It is.
And it's
just
so wonderful, and the vibe is always good, and the people are so friendly, and the music is affordable, and it's always been affordable. And then you look around, you see all the beautiful art, and the show has changed. The last time I was there was a show with was a photography exhibit, and I'm drawing a blank on the photographer. I can't think of his name. One of my favorite photographers, and he had, like, some Miles Davis. I'm like, oh, my God. And some other folks that are no longer with us.
Oh, you're going to see Ella. You're going to see Etta. You're going to see Miles. You see Michael Jackson. You're going to see so many artists just enjoying. They're right there with us when we're performing, and I think that adds also to the performances over there. It's a wonderful place. This is they call Floyd Pelham 57th Street Gallery. That's right, Floyd Pelham. And so come on out.
Yeah,
come on, you know, tomorrow
support,
will be a
support live music.
Yeah. And the weather is going to support us tomorrow. You watch, it's going to be a beautiful day and a beautiful evening. And thank you, Wanda.
So, you're welcome, Kwame. See you tomorrow night. Have a great, beautiful day today.
You too.
All right. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, you set me up for a wonderful day, and I hope you enjoy yours too. Have an excellent one.
All right. Thank you so much. All right. You too. Peace and blessings.
Thank you. Peace.
Peace. So the Melvin Butts Ensemble Jazz Extravaganza featuring Kwame Thompson is Saturday, November 23rd at Floyd Pelham 57th Street Gallery. Doors open at 5. Admission is $15. The address is 5701 Telegraph Avenue in Oakland. Phone number is 510-654-6974. And you can get tickets at the door, but you might want to just make a reservation because, you know, this is an annual event, and it was so good last year. You know, you might find yourself standing up in the back. You might want to make a reservation.
You just might.
Yeah, you just might. I mean, I've seen it like that. All right, Kwame, you take good care.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Wanda.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye. So we're going to conclude the show with a pre-recorded show I broadcast on Wednesday. Marco Hall's interviews before her Bebop Baby opened, which was Tuesday, and it continues through Saturday as well at the Z-Space Studios in San Francisco. Really fabulous production. It's a musical memoir, and it is quite wonderful. And then we conclude our conversation with the directors of Promise, American Promise, which opens at the New Parkway Theater in Oakland this evening or this afternoon or today, November 22nd. So it's a great interview with both of these, well, the three of these artists. Margo Hall precedes the direct Joy. Oh, and I want to put a plug in for my girl, Idris Anifa Woshe Cooper. She's doing her her piece at Eastside Arts Cultural Center. Her piece about sort of being a black girl, sort of traveling throughout. I'm trying to think, not just Africa, but I think, and is it Africa or is it Europe? Anyway, sort of is the adventures of. I don't know the name exactly, but it's adventures of Idris sort of traveling as a black girl, and she externalizes her experiences being, you know, in the container that she's in, and it's quite fun and it's quite insightful, and it's Idris is such a good writer and actress and director. So this piece again is that. It's the second week and it's closing week, and it's at Eastside Arts Culture Center, and it's tonight and tomorrow. I don't know if there's a Sunday, but it's definitely tonight and tomorrow. So you can visit Eastside Arts on the website. All righty, so those are my announcements. You take good care, and thanks for joining another edition of Wanda's Picks, and tune in on Wednesday, 6 o'clock Pacific time, for a continuing conversation about art and culture and revolution and revolutionaries and how art changes societies for the better, and the artists are the true revolutionaries. And I want to offer my condolences to the family of Lupesi, who made her transition last week, and her funeral was, not a funeral, but her homegoing and celebration was yesterday, and it was quite beautiful. And we wish Lupesi much love on her ascension, and we will definitely keep her in our hearts, and we know that she is with us forever now, now that she has. So to finish this this experience of, you know, this human experience, and gone on to, you know, the next phase in her spiritual life and development.
Go Queen Linda.
Hambone, the way you been, round the corner and back again. Mm-hmm. A hambone, where you wife, oh, yeah. In the kitchen cooking rice. A hambone,
hambone.
Give me hambone, give me some hambone. Well now, hambone, put them on your shoulder. Mm-hmm. If you get a pretty girl, I'll show you how to hold her. Mm-hmm. Hambone, where you been, all around the world and back again.
Talking about the hambone. What you gonna do? Got in a train and a fella flew.
Come
said down. Hambone, where did you go?
Yeah.
Miss Lucy, I'll tell the story now. Miss Lucy, would you marry me? Well, I don't care if Papa don't care.
Ha.
Hambone.
Baba to the bone,
to the head.
Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, the Black Arts and Culture Program of the African Sisters Media Network. That's and Michaela, Being in Love, CD, Ham Bone.
I said, Hambone, Hambone, have you heard? Mama gonna buy me a mockingbird. And if that mockingbird don't sing, Mama gonna buy me a diamond ring. And if that diamond ring don't shine, Mama gonna buy me a sister wine. And if that sister wine get broke, Mama gonna buy me a billy goat. But if that billy don't run, Mama gonna buy me a BB gun. And if that BB gun don't shoot, Mama gonna buy me a swimming suit. So if some of them get on me, Mama gonna whip my baby feet. Hambone! Lord, hand bone, Lord, hand bone, 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 hand bone, hand bone, oh, hand bone.
Going to look at family legacies this morning. First, in the life of Margot Hall, as she pays tribute in her world premiere, A Bebop Baby, a musical memoir, currently at Z Space in San Francisco, opened last night, November 19th, and continues through Saturday, November 23rd, San Francisco, so you definitely don't want to miss it. This is Miss Hall's tribute to the life of her beloved stepfather, artist and musical ambassador of Detroit, Teddy Harris, Jr. And she also shares the story of her biological father, Armsby Hall. And so this story, Bebop, is a love story. A love story, that of a daughter for her father, the man who raised her and made her mother so happy. And she and her sisters, you know, so feel so loved. And it is also the story of forgiveness for a biological father who is still, you know, with us. And this collaboration with the Marcus Shelby Jazz Orchestra, 15 pieces, live music, it's just phenomenal. And Margot Hall, not only is she front and center in this work, she also writes all the lyrics to the songs, which Marcus Shelby puts music to. So there's original music, there's a riveting, fantastic story, and or journey, and dance, and it's just wonderful, wonderful. Many of us think we know Margot Hall, the actress, award-winning actress, who has been in so many productions. She's also a director and a playwright. She directed Sonny's Blues by James Baldwin for San Francisco-based company Word for Word, which toured in France. She co-directed Bull Rusher with Ellen Sebastian Chang, a new play by Issa Davis, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. And Ms. Hall recently received rave reviews in Jessica Hagedorn's Faye in the Desert as the character Faye. She has performed for Arena, Stage, Olney Theater, and Source Theater in Washington, D.C., the Guthrie Theater in Indianapolis, and locally at the American Conservatory Theater, Berklee Repertory Theater, Magic Theater, Bravo for Women in the Arts. She's a founding member of Campo Santo and a resident theater company at Intersection for the Arts, and they just finished a tour. She was also seen recently at the California Shakespeare Theater in a number of roles. The one that I saw her in was as a company member for Spunk, but she's also been in other plays there. But this one is her work, and something about seeing, the writer, center stage in something as personal as this story is, and so well done. And Margot writes in the program notes that this journey of writing her stories began many years ago with her dear friend Ellen Sebastian Chang. Ellen loved Margot's stories and encouraged her to record them and eventually write them down. And she says, Margot says in the program notes, this particular puzzle piece of my life's journey is a semi-autobiographical memoir about forgiveness and reconciliation. Some things are autobiographical and some things are exaggerated as all memories go. She's talked about her amazing childhood growing up as a daughter of Detroit's power couple, the Grand Dame Martha Hall Harris and jazz great Teddy Harris Jr. And she says she has so many memories of Detroit that make her who she is today. Many of these memories come from her basement, where her stepfather Teddy made and played his music. And then she talks about Marcus Shelby, who is a character in this particular production where she has three other actors join her to help her tell the story. She has, besides Marcus Shelby as himself and as Teddy Harris Jr., she also has Mujahid Abdul Rashid, who plays her father, her biological father, in ensemble. Don Troop, she plays the mother as well as ensemble, and Halili Knox plays the sister and ensemble. And there are special guests, and so last night we were joined, Tiffany, I don't remember Tiffany's last name, but there was a special guest in a number where Margot, as the character, shares the story of when she was on stage. She was the fourth Supreme, because the Supremes were also people that were in her life. And so anyway, it's just really great, particularly if you love good music and a great story. Definitely don't want to miss Bebop Baby, a musical memoir. Again, it's through November 23rd. So that's our first interview with Margot. She was generous enough to talk to us Monday, the day before opening night, and we had a great conversation that morning. And then we shift to another wonderful story with different outcomes. This time it's from the perspective of the parents. We have directors Joe Brewster and his wife Michelle Stephenson join us to talk about American Promise, which is a film that spans 13 years as the co-directors, middle-class African-American parents in Brooklyn, New York, turn the camera on their son, Idris, and his best friend, Seon. And they chronicle, they capture pivotal moments in their educational journey from kindergarten to high school in one of this nation's most prestigious private schools. What is America's promise to its citizens, and does its educational system uphold this for these families? That is a question you have to answer yourself when you see the film. Opening just a week ago in the San Francisco Bay Area in Oakland this Friday, November 22nd at the New Parkway, American Promise takes this nation to task as it shows how even among the best schools, it is still not doing its best for its black boys. So we have a very wonderful extended conversation with the directors. And American Promise is actually going to be one of the, on PBS, public broadcasting on POV in this, I guess, the winter, in February 2014. So as there is a great website that you can visit to find out more about the film. But in the meantime, as I mentioned, it's in Bay Area theaters. It's at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco, the Rialto Cinemas, Elmwood in Berkeley, the Regal in Jack London Square in Oakland, and again, it's opening at the New Parkway this Friday, November 22nd. So you definitely want to catch it. It's quite a journey, So we're going to open again with Margo Hall talking about Bebop Baby, and you definitely look for the recording because the music is fantastic. If you know anything about Marcus Shelby, you know that it is really nice. And then, you know, Margo Hall, who would have known? I didn't know Margo also wrote music. So, yeah, it's just really fantastic, really fantastic. So here we go. Let's see. Margo Hall, Bebop Baby. So, you know, it goes without saying, Margo, that you're one of the first ladies of theater here in the San Francisco Bay Area. And with your new piece, Bebop Baby, a musical memoir, you know, that might we might be able to say, you know, nationally and internationally.
You're very kind. Thank you.
Oh, well, you know, I just heard little snippets of your story about growing up in Detroit, you know, with a famous stepfather, right? And how your living room was a place where the stars frequently visited. So.
Actually, in the basement.
The basement was
the place where everything went down, where all the music and laughter and love happened was in the basement in Detroit.
Yeah, so what years are we speaking with regards to this legacy? Because I know they're before you were born and they extend, you know, afterwards. So what era are we talking about?
Well, my stepdad, Teddy Harris Jr., the late Teddy Harris Jr., he worked with Motown back in the 60s, 70s. I'm speaking more of the late 60s, early 70s. Mm-hmm. That's around the time I was around.
Okay.
And being a part of his world in Motown. And like I said, he was my stepfather, and he and my mom married when I was about 12 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I met him when I was about 10 years old. And he was, you know, he was very different from my biological father. He was a musician, and he was a cool cat, just very different. And it took me a while to figure him out because he wasn't my dad. But and all that is expressed in the play.
Mm-hmm.
And then slowly our relationship began to grow, and a lot of it was based on both of us being creative beings and being in the arts, and our respect for theater and music and all of those things that became our way of communication. And he was one of the most prominent artists in Detroit. And he, like I said, he played with Motown. He toured with Aretha Franklin for years as her musical director, worked with Martha Reeves and the Vandellas and Kim Weston, and then he later became the music director for the Supremes.
Really?
And, yeah. Wow. And so I had a lifelong relationship with Mary Wilson of the Supremes, who was like an aunt to me, still is. Mm-hmm. And my house was just frequented by a lot of Motown artists. So for me, they were just people who worked hard and were talented. Mm-hmm. So my view of it was a little bit different. I didn't really see, I understood that they were famous, but they were presented to me as just, you know, hardworking artists, and it gave me a lot of my discipline and the way I go about my work came from the influence of all these famous, amazing people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, yeah.
Wow, wow. So do you, in your work, talk about sort of the landscape, you know, that was Detroit at that particular time, because Detroit now is quite different.
Right.
You know, Rosa Parks, she relocated from Montgomery to Detroit, and Detroit is not just a musical capital, but it also is a political capital. I mean, there was a whole lot
of
stuff going on, and I'm sure that impacted the folks that showed up, you know, musically and theatrically in your basement, you know, to work that stuff out, you know, for the people.
Yeah.
Artistically.
Yeah, for sure. It was, you know, it was an amazing time in Detroit, and the Detroit I grew up in was pretty different than the Detroit it is now. I mean, later in my adult years, I'd probably say out of my teenage years into my adult years, things started to change. And Motown was gone. Drugs came into the area, just like most urban cities, and things changed. And it's sad when I go home now to see the state of Detroit, but there's still a lot of hope and a lot of strength in Detroit, and I'm a big fan of my city, and I continue to think and pray that things will change, and I think things go in cycles, so I'm hoping that the vitality will return to Detroit, because there's a lot of talent there, a lot of art there, a lot of music. It's just stifled right now by all the other stuff, but it's there, and it's reemerging.
Right, yeah. So did you, when Diana Ross came through this summer, did you get a chance to hang out with her?
No, I'm not. I'm not that close with Diana Ross. Like I said, Mary Wilson was my was our friend. And by the time I knew the Supremes, Diana Ross was no longer part of the Supremes. I have met her because she has come to concerts. When I was little, she had come to concerts of other Supreme performances.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know her as well as I know, like, Mary Wilson,
mm-hmm.
Because I was, you know, I'm not that old, Wanda.
No. No, you're not that old.
But I mean, like, Aretha Franklin is a really good friend of my family. And
really?
She actually sang at my mom's funeral.
Your mom passed, too? Oh,
yeah.
You know,
my mom passed, yeah. My biological father is still alive, and he's actually also a part of the play.
Oh, okay.
So you'll see that's an interesting little twist there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but your mom and your stepdad, they're...
Yeah, they both passed away, and my mom passed away first.
Mm-hmm.
And Aretha Franklin sang at her funeral. Mm-hmm. She sang Precious Lord at the piano.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh.
Yeah.
And my dad, we had, both of my parents had an orchestra at their funeral that played, not just a singer, but an orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
So, because I, like I said, it was all about the music in my family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then my stepfather passed a few years later after
My
mom. Yeah.
It just seems like, you know, when I hear about Detroit, you know, those years that you're speaking, you know, when it was really robust and, you know, all those fabulous artists were coming through, you know, through Motown, and then your home, you know, the stories that I've heard you talk about when folks, you know, like, James Carter?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the folks would come through and you all be like hanging out, you know, after the set at the club. And I just like watching you all just sort of telling stories. And I was just wondering, how do you set this up, you know, this piece? I know you have a cast, and you're in the play, but you also have some fabulous area artists. And then you have a 14-piece orchestra, you know, with Marcus Shelby nonetheless. And you and Marcus have done things in the past together. I mean, I'm thinking about Sonny's Blues that you directed, the James Baldwin piece for Word for Word, which was like, oh, my, because that was back, you know, when Lorraine Hansberry had a theater.
That's
and
right.
That was
That's
so
right.
marvelous. And
yeah,
and I'm thinking, you know, I'm thinking I might see a little bit of that in your work, the way that you, you know, sort of orchestrated that particular piece and the way that story was so musical in your hands.
Yes. Well, I do have an incredible team with Halimi Knox and Don L. Troop and Mujahid Abdul Rashid. Halimi and Don are my confidants, and they help me on my journey in the story. Mujahid plays my real father and also is also one of the singers. The music is incredible. Marcus and I, like you said, have collaborated over the years, and it's been really exciting to get back together and do this. It's really, truly a spiritual, mental, physical journey with music and dance. We have a little dancing going on. We have singing. And we have story. And the music, I pretty much wrote the lyrics to the songs and the melodies, and I would send it to Marcus on an MP3, and he would turn it into this fantastic orchestration. And it's amazing to hear music that I've had in my head forever come to life that way. And Marcus has been extremely generous in working with me and my changes and, oh, I don't want it that way, I want it this way. And he's just an incredible composer and in person, you know, and we're like brother and sister. We fight like everyone else. I want it this way. Well, you told me this. And then in the end, you know, we're those brothers and sisters who give each other a big hug and say, wow, look what we did. So it's been really wonderful, and I am very blessed to have my cast, who are not just incredible artists, but friends, true, honest friends. And it's nothing like being on stage with people you trust and love and know that they're there for you. Because, this, you know, it's hard to... I'm out there pretty much bearing my soul, telling my secrets, and to know you have someone there holding you up, it's just a wonderful experience. This whole journey has, I've learned a lot about myself, and I've had a great opportunity to work at Z-Space, and their space is a perfect space for this piece, and I'm feeling very grateful and blessed.
I was just thinking, you know, you're a founding member of Campo Santo, and you just had a piece that closed this weekend, And then, you know, you, as you mentioned, you know, that there's choreography and you do everything. You sing, you dance, you direct. Are you still teaching at Chabot?
Yes, I still am.
You're a mother. Oh, my goodness. Your son is at university now. Oh, my goodness.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Is he coming in to see this? Is he going to fly back?
Yeah, we're trying to get him in. You know, he loves school, so he's like, I can't take a day off, but I want to come. So it's like, all right, we'll fly you in for a day and get you back, because he does not like to miss school. But, yeah, hopefully he's part of the story as well. So it would be nice for him to see that. And, yeah, hopefully he can get in. And I have a lot of family coming in from Detroit. They're
so
very
nice.
Excited. My sisters and cousins. And so that's going to be exciting, too, to have them come and see this work.
Yeah. Are you going to have any, like, audience discussions afterwards or anything like that?
I don't think so, but I will say this. There is some audience participation.
Oh, nice.
We will have special guests appearing in the show.
Oh, nice.
I can tell you that our Friday night show is a gala, and we have Claire D, who will be appearing with us in a capacity of the play.
Oh,
I won't tell you anymore, though.
Okay. No, Clarity, she's phenomenal.
And she's also a very good friend of mine, so very excited to have her.
Fabulous. So, well, since you grew up with all this art all around you, performing arts in particular, did you go to that famous Detroit Performing Arts High School?
No, I did not. I went to went to Highland Park High. Highland Park is where I grew up, and that's right in the middle of Detroit. And I did perform in the band. I played the flute. So I still, a lot of schools when I was growing up, where the arts was really prevalent, from middle school to elementary, every school. I had dance, theater, music. That was never a question in Detroit. I don't know nowadays with all the funds being cut what it's like, but they're very, very influenced by art when I was going to school. And so I grew up there, and then I actually went to school to be a dentist.
Really?
Yes. I went to University of Michigan for 2 years to study pre-med.
Oh, wow.
Because I had pretty good grades, and I had options to do that, but I realized that it wasn't for me, and I changed my major to theater, and then I went all the way and pursued theater, moved to New York, went to school there for undergrad, then got my master's degree at Catholic University of America in D.C., and stayed on the path of theater, but so I had kind of a turn there that I took because it was a financial thing, and my mom wanted a doctor in the family, and so, but then we all realized, no way, she's not going to go through with that. And now it's supported all the way.
Nice,
so,
Wow. So what brought you to California? Because it seems like your family is still pretty rooted in Detroit.
Yes. When I was married to L. Peter Callender, we were married in New York, and then he got a job at Berkeley Rep.
Oh, okay.
And we came out then and just decided to stay. And once Brandon was born, it seemed to make sense that we would stay here and make sure he went through school here, and, you know, all of that. So, I mean, I think that, you know, once I was divorced and then Brandon went off to college, everyone kept expecting me to move to New York or go to L.A. You know, I'm finally able to do all those things. But I love the Bay Area, and I've been very successful here. And I love theater here. I think it's some great work going on, and I like being able to influence some of the work that's going on just based on the time I've been here. And I'm a lot like my stepdad. He wanted to. He stayed in Detroit, even though he could have gone anywhere in the world with his talents and his prestige. But he stayed there, and he helped the community there, and he formed a band, a 15-piece orchestra called the New Breed Bebop Society Orchestra that people like James Carter were in, and all of these youngsters who are now famous today. So I'm a lot like him. You know, I stay here in the community. I teach at a community college. I've been there over 15 years. I like my pond. and so this is a very special place to me, and I believe in committing and giving back to what was given me. So
Yeah. That's
why I'm staying in the Bay.
So we're happy that you're staying in the Bay, and we're happy that, gosh, this bebop baby, a musical memoir, is debuting here before it tours, because you know you've been on lots of tours, you know, in your various capacities. So I'm sure this one's going to tour. But yeah, it's really great to have artists of your caliber in the region and in the area and doing this. And, this original work, I mean, nowadays with, the shrinking budgets, it's rare to have original work. And so we have people, doing the classics, whether they're Wilson or Shakespeare or Baldwin or Hurston even, Brenda Shockey. But, new work, It's like, wow, this is so wonderful that you're able to mount new work with music, and some of our favorite, artists are going to be in the cast with you. And I don't know, Sheila Balter, who's your director?
She works with Word for Word.
Okay.
She's with Word for Word, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so congratulations on this wonderful work, and I'm so excited about seeing your life on stage.
Okay.
How trusting of you.
I know. I'm terrified.
And we'll never know, because you're like the ultimate professional, so you might be quaking in your heart, but you know we love you.
Never let them see you sweat.
Totally. Yeah, and you won lots of awards, for your work, as an actress and as a director. So, hopefully this will be another feather in your cap, so to speak.
Yeah, well, I'm very excited about it. And like I said, humbled, grateful.
Mm-hmm.
That this is happening, and that Z-Space is producing this work, and really looking forward to a future with this work, too, and mm-hmm. with my cast. Yeah,
super excellent. And I was wondering, since it is a musical, will the music be available at some point?
We're talking about that. Yes. Okay. And it's, I mean, the score is incredible, so mm-hmm. we do have to do that. Some point.
Yeah, because Marcus has a real extensive publishing career.
Most
of his work eventually is available. So
his music. Oh, you just wait. It's beautiful.
Okay.
Oh, it's just gorgeous.
Wow. Well, tomorrow is opening night, and your gala is Friday, and the run is the 19th through the 23rd, which is Tuesday through Saturday, so mm-hmm. real exciting.
Yes,
congratulations.
Tuesday through Saturday, and Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday are 7 o'clock shows.
Okay.
And Saturday and Sunday are at 8, and like I said Friday and Saturday are at 8,
mm-hmm.
and Friday night is a gala where we have a little reception before and after with some music. And that's the night that Claire D will be appearing on stage with us briefly.
Right. Yeah.
And every night there's a special guest artist. So keep your eye out for some of our Bay Area favorites. Rodessa Jones will be stopping by.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have some exciting people who will be joining us on stage.
Who else? Rodessa, drop some more names. Who else?
Well, there's a young singer that works with Marcus named
mm-hmm.
Tiffany Austin.
Mm-hmm.
Really, really beautiful voice. She's coming by. And I can't give away any more, Wanda.
Okay. Oh, you have to just come for the whole thing because every
yes,
night is going
right.
to be different.
That's right. You don't know when your death is going to be there, so you better just come.
Yeah. Okay. Well, super. Well, all of that's happening at Z-Space, 450 Florida Street. And, wow, that's going to be so awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
I look forward to seeing you, Wanda.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to come tomorrow.
Great.
Yeah, and maybe I can come back through so I can see who your other guests are going to be.
Okay.
But definitely I'm going to be there tomorrow. And a couple of friends of mine, one of my colleagues here at the College of Alameda, she and her husband are Detroit natives. Yeah, and they came to my class and they talked about Detroit, particularly.
Oh, yay.
Yeah, and the years, because we were reading about Rosa Parks in my classes this semester, and I told them that I wanted to treat them to come in and see Bebop Baby, a musical memoir, you know, featuring yourself and Marcus Shelby Jazz Orchestra, because, you know, I knew they would love it because one of the things they were talking about was Motown and the music and how the artists would perform in the community centers, and they go and there they'd be like really close and they could mingle and it was like really affordable or free and it's just, you know, the artists were part of the community in a way that, you know, we don't necessarily see our artists anymore the way, you know, it was in the past.
Yeah, like that, yeah. Mm-hmm. It was very community-oriented, and they really, that's how they could influence so many other youngsters because they were accessible.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed attainable, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
Definitely. And you're accessible. I mean, you're sharing your creativity with so many different audiences. Go ahead.
No, I was saying, and I love working with young people and teaching them the discipline of theater and art and the commitment and all of those wonderful things. It's not just about stardom. It's about hard work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very important.
Right.
So I really enjoy that as well.
Cool. Well, you take good care, and I will see you in the theater.
Yes. All right. Thank you, Wanda. Always a pleasure. Okay.
Bye-bye. Mm-hmm. So that was Margot Hall, and again, Bebop Baby, a musical memoir, is a wonderful, wonderful journey. You definitely don't want to miss it. So Z-Space through Saturday the 23rd, and Friday is Friday, November 22nd, is a special evening that's going to feature a gala, and Clara D is going to be performing, so it should be really nice. But every evening, there's going to be a special guest, and that's a wonderful number, too, with the special guests. So, again, we are joined in the studio next by co-directors Joe Brewster and Michelle Stevenson. Joe Brewster and his partner Michelle Stevenson produced and directed American Promise. Brewster is a Harvard and Stanford educated psychiatrist who moved to New York City to pursue media studies in the service of social change. In 1996, he wrote and directed his first film, The Keeper, an official selection at the Sundance Film Festival that year. Brewster and Stevenson have since produced and directed two narrative films and three feature-length documentaries while raising their two sons in Brooklyn. Michelle Stevenson is a graduate of McGill University and Columbia Law School. She uses her background in critical studies, race, and human rights to inform her documentary work. An early pioneer in the Web 2.0 revolution, Stevenson began her film career working with the video advocacy group Witness, where she used video and the Internet to structure human rights campaigns around the globe. Her work has appeared on PBS, Showtime, MTV, and other outlets. Stevenson's honors include the Silver Docs Diversity Award and the Henry Hampton Award for Excellence in Film and Digital Media. I just want to tell you that I really enjoyed the journey of American Promise you know, what a wonderful gift you've given us here in America as citizens, to be able to travel with you and your family and the other members of the extended community and your extended family, you know, as these young people journey through a school system, you know, and, you know, from kindergarten all the way to high school. I mean, my goodness. And then in your homes, and then in those intimate moments between parents and children, you know, when there might be a little discord and discomfort, the camera is there.
Yes, it was. however, it wasn't there as much as you might think. You know, we shot 800 hours worth of footage.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is a lot of film or videotape. But when you look at it over time, it was about 5 hours a week, a month. So I think it feels a lot more intimate, and that's what we wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a lot to do with cutting style and shooting style. We tended to avoid interviews, and because of that, you are constantly getting a slice of life. The film is shot, and it's cut in an observational manner. And you know, when I say that, you also have to add in the fact that the characters over time become comfortable with observation. And so what they do is they relax, and you get a more cinematic and a truthful feeling when watching them. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think also part of what, you know, allows the audience to feel like they, you know us more, or are kind of in the moment, or part that they're living an intimate experience, is really this kind of rare access to really seeing someone grow literally before your eyes, specifically with Idris and Cheyenne. I mean, we really see them become young men,
mm-hmm.
and somehow that adds to a feeling like, you know, we know these guys, right, as an audience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then I think about both your backgrounds. You know, Jill, you are a psychiatrist, and Michelle, you're an attorney.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. So, some of the, you know, what your children experience and what the children experience, particularly, you know, in the film, you know, Seon and Idris. Just wondering, sort of, how your academic background prepared you for some of the situations that you encounter as directors and as parents with regards to the two boys navigating this this school system, as well as, you know, the public domain, you know, just being black boys, you know, in America.
You know, I'm sure our trainings helped us considerably.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're in the trenches, the parenting trenches,
mm-hmm.
you basically, reflex kicks in. And so what you see early on is as a reflex, you know, and a lot of it comes from, you know, the way we were parented by our own parents. And so we had to reject some of that.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, develop our own sense of what we needed to do under conditions of stress and anxiety and actually wanting to help. I think what we realized over time is that our anxiety sometimes causes us to reflexly act when we needed to listen or hug. And I think that's an important lesson for us. And I think that's something you may get in the books, but it's not something that you're able to access on the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to add a couple of things to that. One, I think that there are a couple of things that I think helped us navigate these waters. Yes, there were moments of added pressure, but I think, one, Joe's training as a therapist, I think really helped us unpack a lot of the material we were unpacking, whether it was the interviews or conversations and dialogues we've had with Idris, and allowing him to, in some cases in front of the camera, but oftentimes off camera, talk about his social-emotional side and what he was feeling and how he was confronting certain issues around assumptions about him. The therapy side really helped us dialogue and dig deep and also helped find a narrative for him as parents to really find a space where he could have a core, a sense of self that could help him kind of confront the larger world. And some of those, a lot of those conversations happened off camera, but the camera allowed us really to deal with certain dialogues that otherwise we may not have had, but that Joe's training kind of helped foster. From the lawyer side, I think there's this, you know, I've done a lot of work around human rights and issues of racial theory and working on issues of discrimination. So I think in some cases we came with a heightened sense of interpreting our environment in a certain way, and I think we engaged the teachers with that perspective in mind. And in some cases, I think certain teachers were more receptive to that kind of a dialogue and interpreting how they were reacting to Idris. But in other cases, it was a more difficult, you know, kind of a dialogue. But I think what we understood is that in all cases, you know, and what we've understood as we've done the research as well is that it is important to talk about, you know, these microaggressions that the boys face, and that we must talk about it with them, and so that we process it, that they can process it, and so that everyone can be aware of it and be able to engage from a point of information and more self-confidence as a result.
Did you want to say something, Joe?
You know, so if we start at the top, you know, American Promise is a 13-year longitudinal documentary where we made a decision when he was at 5 years old to follow him with a camera and four of his other classmates until their graduation from high school. The initial thought was based on our observation of other documentary filmmakers, specifically Michael Apted in his 7-Up series. We thought we would be able to enter the world of the independent school, a school which made a commitment to make its student body mirror the city of New York. For us, that was very exciting. We were going to enter this world that we had not known, the rigorous private school world. We were going to enter this world, the rigorous private school world, and we were going to have a perspective from the gaze of an African-American family and these five characters. It was a diverse group of young men and women. Over time, the girls left the project. They remained in the school, ultimately graduated, but they left the project. And we were left with two African-American boys, both from Brooklyn, fish out of water, in a sense, but certainly struggling with day-to-day issues, not all having to do with race or academics. The lovely thing about the project is that we get a chance to see these boys come of age. And one of the radical things about the project is how often do you get a chance to see an African-American middle-class boy come of age, it's almost non-existent. So that's where we began. And then life happened. The project unfolded in a way that we did not anticipate. And we had to react not only as filmmakers, but as parents. And therein lies the difficulty of being a filmmaker parent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was thinking about, you know, when I was reading the notes about how you were looking for, you know, a particular type of school, and you were noticing, you know, sort of all of these different types of segregation, you know, in different kinds of ways, whether that was gifted and talented or something else. And I was just sort of reflecting on, you know, Brown versus Board of Education and the Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas in 1957, and James Meredith, you know, integrating with the University of Mississippi in 1962. And then we have Idris and Seyoun and the three girls in 1976. So it's like,
names are changed, but the stories are the same.
Yeah.
And dealing with explicit bias, explicit segregation, we deal with an implicit form. But the impact is just as powerful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every day our sons are given an implicit message of inequality. They're followed in stores. They're stopped and frisked. They shop and then they're frisked. We see obvious examples of this, and many of us have drank the Kool-Aid. And what most scientists are saying is that, now we don't want to paint a pessimistic picture because we acknowledge that things are getting better. But for parents and students who have a realistic view of what's going on around them and talk about it, they get better faster, and they thrive at an exponential rate.
Right. They're able to address the implicit, you know, unconscious racism that happens. And I think, you know, looking at those historical moments that you're talking about, you know, racism still exists, but it's different. And it's about these implicit messages that sometimes happen with the best of intentions by teachers on a daily basis, and by all of us, really, because when we are in a space where, you know, the media bombards us with negative messages about black boys, we all internalize it, whether it has to do with the expectations that we have of these boys academically, or...
I'm trying to give you an example. The Schott Foundation did a study on media, and they looked at news in Pittsburgh. This is, was it 2011?
Mm-hmm.
They found that 85% of the images on the news that dealt with African-American boys were about their criminality. That's a couple of years ago. And so imagine that you turn on the news every day, and that's what you hear, and that's what you see that you can be and that you are. That is a difficult thing not to internalize. That is a difficult thing to have to worry about. And so what we're just saying simply is that when parents talk about this, they can dispel the association that that is who you have to be. But when parents talk about how equal things are, it sets us up for failure. It sets our young boys up for failure from which we cannot recover. It's not that we're going to experience these things, but it's how we recover from them, how we prepare our sons. You know, they always talk about the talk. Well, the talk is not a talk. It's a conversation, and it lasts a decade. if you want your boy to be successful.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, definitely what comes through from both sets of parents in the film is that the successful child is the child that has engaged parents. You had to be there for him. You had to participate because, you know, with Idris and Seon, you know, they started this desegregation process as kindergartners, whereas with the Central High School students, they were teenagers, and with James Meredith, he was a young adult. So, you know, not only are Idris and Seon, you know, sort of at a time when their sense of themselves are being shaped and formed and hopefully, you know, their image is nurtured by family and extended society, and then they are in Dalton School where this is not always what's happening. You know, when we hear, you know, Idris, the character, saying how, you know, they're getting blamed for things. Like, something happens and it's all, you know, they point to the black kids first. And then he goes to a dance and he, no one wants to dance with him. And he goes to party, he can't get a date. And, you know, those kind of things. And then the basketball saga, that's really sad. Because he loves basketball. So anyway, it's just sort of watching those things. And then, you know, when you bring in another school, you know, Benjamin Banneker Academy, where Seon ends up going, just looking at the compassion there as compared to the more sterile, intellectual type of atmosphere in Dalton, I mean, it's like, you know, you can really see the difference with around that. Not that. Sorry, go ahead.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. But let's get something clear.
Yes.
That to raise a healthy, self-loving African American boy,
mm-hmm.
It takes more than academics and more than a warm environment. It takes a mix of both environments, and there are issues with the Banneker environment that are equally concerning, and as well as issues with the Dalton environment.
Mm-hmm.
What we like to say is that what we want, it is an environment educationally that addresses the needs of all boys, where we can promote their social emotional support as well as their academic proficiency. There's an issue of demandingness that's required. And that is a flip side of the implicit bias debate. We have to demand more of our boys. We have to have higher expectations, not only academically, but morally, emotionally. That is not being done by everybody who touches their lives. You know, a lot of our sons are raised in single parent homes,
mm-hmm.
and I think that I, as an African American man, have a responsibility to be there for my neighbor and my neighbor's son, and we try to do that, but it's a big issue that this film only begins to touch on some of the issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I don't know. I'm not certain if this was, I know you had a lot of footage, but I really didn't see, I saw Idris changing to fit the school. I didn't see the school changing to address his, to dress him like he's a black boy, and the school, according to one of the teachers that you interviewed or had on camera, the girls do better than the boys. So, and she mentioned, you know, that's a failing on the part of the school, but I didn't see the school doing anything, you know, insofar as I didn't hear anything that the school was doing to make it better. I don't know if you're putting your Idris's younger brother in that school. I don't know if he's there. Is he there?
Well, a couple of things. The
yes.
school, when high school came around,
mm-hmm.
because actually we were looking for another high school. by the time the end of middle school came around, we were ready to try something different for Idris, because we felt he needed that social and emotional support. And we looked around, and when the school found out that we were looking, they actually courted us to stay and promised a number of things that actually they came through with, but that wasn't as explicitly shown on camera. One was that there was definitely a larger number of students, of high school students of color who came into the school of similar backgrounds as Idris. So he found a cohort of friends, some of which you see that are sprinkled throughout in the scenes in the film, that gave him a certainly sense of ownership of the space more. But I think most importantly is they paired him with an African-American male advisor who basically provided a lot of social and emotional support for him, as well as academic guidance through his four years at the school. And Idris himself, you know, took initiative upon himself to take classes that were Afrocentric in theme, whether it was African American history or literature. Every year he was taking some kind of African-centered themed course elective that allowed him, I think, to feel validated within that environment, and they did provide those courses. So there were things there, some of which we just didn't expose as much in the school because our access was not as unlimited as we would have liked it to be. But the high school was definitely a different experience. That's not to say they can. There's a lot more that they can do, they still. I think there's still much growth, of course, to happen. Idris found his way in high school, and I think there were both in terms of some of the opportunities that were presented at the school, but also, you know, some of the efforts that we made at home that were non-academic, that had to do with, you know, supporting his sense of narrative, giving him more of this family narrative that he needed to be grounded in, whether it was, you know, traveling to family on a more regular basis. And also we supported him with his other friends of color at school and outside of school as well.
Joe, do you have anything you want to say, or should I keep on going?
No, you can keep going. I'm listening to Michelle.
Okay. I'm glad
one
you...
One more thing I do want to say.
Yes,
I think
Michelle.
That part of... I'm glad you kind of note that history earlier is the fact that we need to understand and also communicate to our children in the process that someone like Idris has every right to be in an environment like the Dalton School and own that environment. Because of our common history, because we know that these schools train the leaders of our country and provide an academic rigor that allows them to think critically about their environment and beyond, that gives us tools that no one can take away from them. The exceptional type of intellectual training they get, it's something that he will be able to walk with for the rest of his life, but also the exposure that he gets to how these 1% live, while validating his own experience and knowing what he can take and he can leave and know, you know, how things certain operate, and understand that he's there for an education, not necessarily to feel lesser, and that's our job, that he will end up, you know, with... multiple skill levels in terms of being able to navigate different environments that he's going to have to be exposed to later in life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's sort of what I'm hearing, and I saw it a little bit, but more so I saw how hard you two had to work as parents to help him keep up with all of this academic rigor. But what I hear is that, and Joe, you mentioned it as well, that that as parents, you know, you took it upon yourselves, and of course you should, to be responsible for your child's, you know, social-emotional well-being. But then when you send them out, you know, to the lions, you know, when he comes back, you know, somewhat shredded, you got to patch him up, you know, and send him back. And I'm like, wow, what sacrifice, you know, of this precious person, you know, that you bore. And, yeah, I mean, was it for the greater good or what?
That's a $64,000 question. And my point, if he comes out whole, it appears to us to have been worth it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's a nice young man. He's empathic. He's honest. His writing skills and math skills are through the roof. But it's not without the battle, the day-to-day battle, and we were prepared to support him in a number of areas. Everyone doesn't have this, and they should. But let's look at what's happening around the world. You know, there are more honor students working at the level that my son is working than there are people in the United States, and these people will go on to be the creators of the new science, new computer technology. It is imperative that we develop as African American the same skill set that's being developed in Singapore and Japan and in Vietnam and China, and we can do that. But really, it takes a commitment and time and patience. And I think we had that capital to spend. The question is, how can a country like Singapore develop it for all of their kids, or Denmark, or Sweden? And so that's what we would like to see. We would like to see a bigger investment so that single-parent kids can avail themselves of computer science and technology.
This type of access should be for all children, and that's where we should be headed as a society here, so that we as parents don't have to make these difficult choices around a social and emotional environment versus a rigorously academic environment. We should be able to have access to both and be able to choose amongst quality, not between, you know, less quality versus more quality in one area, and then have to, you know, fill in the gap as a result.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then also, you know, bringing in safety, you know, at the Benjamin Banneker Academy, you know, your child might not have been safe because, you know, on film there is a disruption at a fundraiser where the kids are getting ready to go to Africa, I believe, and Seon says, you know, like, okay, well, this happens a lot. I'm like,
Well, let's be clear that Banneker is a safe environment,
mm-hmm.
and Banneker is one of the top performing high schools, public high schools in Brooklyn. But their top students are not even in the middle of the class of an institution like Dalton.
Mm-hmm.
Banneker requires more resources. It was a school which was hampered by a doubling of its population. That school provided Saturday classes and had quite supportive teachers who are feeling overwhelmed as we speak by the increase in caseload and the lack of resources. If the Banneker of 5 years ago still existed, it would be an amazing experience, and I think we're hopefully going to get back to that with our new mayor.
Oh, nice, nice, yeah. So what did you decide for your younger son?
We decided a number of things. One, we decided that we would support him earlier, that we sent him to a independent school, the Brooklyn Friends School, which is closer to our home, where we decreased the amount of commute time that he has to deal with on a weekly basis. We hope that contributes to a more supportive local environment, social emotional support from his local community.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have a clear idea on how to engage the school. We're at the school more frequently. I would say 10-20 times a year, either for book fairs or PTA meetings or class trips. We think that's a pretty important part of the process. But what we're also trying to do, and this is part of our outreach campaign, is we're trying to engage with other parents in small groups, because that's where you really learn about what's going on. That's where you get your pulse on information, and you have a sense of how your son is being understood. You know, we were at a parent-teacher conference last week, and that teacher spoke to us about our son not only academically, but about his emotional health. And we left the meeting feeling like he was in good hands. And we could only have that by a deeper dive with students. I'm sorry, with the teaching staff. And that's what we strive for.
Nice, yeah. You capture quite well the difficulties of being, you know, black and male in America. You know, as we mentioned earlier in our conversation, you know, sometimes it could be dangerous and scary. And Idris talks about, you know, sort of navigating, you know, trying to be, you know, with the boys in the hood, and then also, you know, feeling more comfortable, you know, at the academy, because he can be all of who he is there, as opposed to, you know, having to code shift or, you know, sort of navigate that split or that two-ness that Frantz Fanon and W.E.B. Du Bois talks about. And mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could talk about maybe, you know, sort of why it's so hard to be a black boy in America, and specifically, Joe, how you made it through, and then Michelle, if you could talk about raising a black male child.
Well, we actually did a New York Times op-doc, which is 10 minutes. You can probably Google it at
totally.
New York Times op-docs.
Okay.
Education in equality.
Okay.
And it's a 10-minute piece during which my son does most of the narration,
mm-hmm.
Talking about his two-ness, to quote him.
Nice.
And his struggle to come to terms with both sides of his identity. That is essential for us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's essential for him to grow up and be productive. If he denies one part of himself, he denies all of himself. And so, or part of my existence, I come from a lower middle class African American community in Los Angeles. It would be a shame for him to have to be to deny that part of his existence. Likewise, to deny part of his mother's Haitian or Panamanian culture. Mm-hmm. So what we dealt with is a constant discussion of his feelings regarding that, his feelings about his grandma or the home in which we stayed during vacations in Petronville, Haiti.
Oh.
And over time, by, you know, using ourselves as examples and coming to terms with strong feelings that he might have one way or the other, I think he's become a healthier human being. You know, it's like he has to learn a couple of languages,
mm-hmm.
and when you learn two languages, it may take you longer time to master both. Well, what we're seeing now at age 20, as a sophomore at Occidental College in California, he's really come to terms with who he is and what he wants to do, and we're able to sit back and spend our time concerned about the younger son.
But I think part of our responsibility is, of course, to help him be able to come to terms with those multiple identities and be proud of himself and develop a core that is that's grounded. But it's I can't say it's not stressful. I mean, there is this overlying kind of anxiety, but also kind of weight, understanding that as a black male, we can protect him but so much. We can prepare him. We can make sure he has an education that no one takes it away from him. We can help him have a complex sense of identity of who he is and how he can navigate these different worlds. And give him the preparation for the potential to be whoever he wants to be, career-wise or otherwise, but also prepare him for the reality of what it is for him to walk down the street and people perceive him certain ways, and him having to be the victim of those perceptions. We need to prepare him for that as well. And that's the kind of waters that we navigate as parents of African-American boys. Mm-hmm. Preparing for the full optimistic potential and the sense of self that is complicated, but proud, but also understanding that not everybody thinks of them that way, and they need to be careful.
So Wanda, let me ask you a couple of questions.
Yes.
Off the record.
Okay, let me stop this tape.
when is this going to be aired?
Oh, I was thinking about Wednesday of coming week, my next show.
So what we wanted to do is tell you where we're going to be.
Super.
You're in Oakland, right?
Yes, I'm in Alameda, but, you know, close, yeah.
So what your audience should know mm-hmm. is that we are currently at the Roxy Theater mm-hmm. in San Francisco,
okay.
the Jack London in Oakland,
mm-hmm.
and the Elmwood.
And in Berkeley, yeah.
In Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
We will probably continue to be at a couple of those theaters next week.
Oh, super.
But,
nice.
But the Parkway will be opening the film on November 22nd.
Friday the 22nd. Okay, excellent.
So we'll say that again. Michelle, why don't you...
Do you want me to say it again?
Yes.
Hello?
Yeah. Oh, sure, go ahead. If you want to.
We're opening theatrically...
Today.
today at the Rialto, the Roxy, Elmwood, and the Jack London in Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
And we will also be opening in Oakland at the New Parkway on November 22nd.
That'd be awesome. And you're in town?
Yes, we are in town for Q&As over the opening weekend at the Jack London, mm-hmm. the Elmwood, and at the Roxy as well. Okay. Look for your local listings to see which Q&As we'll be participating in.
Okay, great. And you're going to stay through Friday the 22nd? Is that what you just said?
No, that's only for this weekend.
Oh, so you won't be here next weekend as well?
We won't be here next weekend, no.
Oh, okay.
Unfortunately. No.
Okay.
I think it's important for your audience to know that not only have we made this film, but we have an extensive outreach program where we're working with teachers, schools, students, and parents.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be doing that over the next year, trying to create a greater awareness of this issue of African-American male achievement. You know, there are several thousand organizations around the country who are working hard to end this achievement gap, and we think that we are on a tipping point.
Yeah, and for us, part of this community engagement work that we're doing, along with many partners actually even in Oakland and other parts of the country, is the film is really just a conversation starter. I mean, we are clearly engaged in working with other organizations and groups to really look at solutions to helping narrow the black male achievement gap. We have a book that we've published that's coming out early next year in 2014 about raising black boys, where it calls information from experts around the country. The book is called Promises Kept. And we understand that we're part of this larger movement, of which we actually have recently seen that things are looking brighter, certainly for African-American male students in Oakland. I understand that the graduation rate has increased over the last year and a half, and it's partially due to some of the efforts and solutions that many of us know exist but are just not implemented as systematically as needed.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, in Oakland we have a high school that was developed by 100 black men, which is an all-boys public charter high school. And they're supposed to be, you know, doing some really, really good work there. They actually have an art exhibit that's opening this weekend at the African American Art and Culture Complex, where they're telling stories, you know, through the StoryCorps. They've actually, I think they have like 100 stories, and so they're going to be, that's opening this weekend, and it's going to be continuing through next year. So maybe you could pop through there while you are in town.
Definitely, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we know some of the people involved in the 100 Black Men School.
Oh, super, super.
Yeah.
Yeah, any of the your local collaborators that you might want to mention?
Well, there is 100 Black Men in Schools. There's Policy Link that's in the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm.
It's been working with us as well. The Great Schools as well have been big supporters and collaborators of ours.
Mm-hmm.
Game Changers. It's also an organization that's actually adopted a screening that will be at one of our theatrical screenings over the opening weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And there are Mocha Moms, the Mocha Moms Oakland chapter.
Uh-huh.
Will be our big partners of ours, actually the National Mocha Moms. So we've had chapters from across the country work with us around the theatrical release, including Mocha Moms Oakland. So there's a nice network of folks that we'll be seeing through the theatrical release.
Oh, that's awesome. That's really awesome. Oh, great. Oh, maybe I'll try to get to one of the Q&As after one of the screenings since you're in town so I can meet you. That'd be really super.
That would be nice, yes.
Yeah. Well, cool. Well, I look forward to perhaps having another conversation after your book is released at the beginning of next year and you have your POV, debut on the air.
Yes.
That'll be February 3rd.
Mm-hmm.
We will be broadcast nationally on the PBS series, POV, on February 3rd.
Right. Yeah, that's really awesome. And if you have time for one more question, I just had one more.
Okay.
Yeah, I was wondering how being a creative team has enhanced the depth of your relationship as parents.
You want to take? I often, at times during this filmmaking process, during some of the painful moments of wondering whether, you know, I was doing the right thing as a parent, ultimately realized as I was going through these experiences that our response to processing our lives and relationship to our son and to education, our response as artists was to pick up the camera, and that camera actually helped. It helped in so many different ways, both in terms of it allowed us to deal with painful issues in a way that I think ultimately became more constructive. And I think it was our way of processing things. And the camera became a tool to finding solutions as parents and to also be more self-reflective, ultimately, as parents. And to engage in dialogue with our son and with our friends and with the school. So ultimately, you know, it's kind of a contrarian thinking. You know, our instinct is to think, well, you put up the camera, you know, there's a certain level of privacy and intimacy that's lost. But I think in this case, by exposing some of these painful issues through the use of the camera, it really allowed us to go places that we needed to go to that we might not have otherwise. And I think about this not just in terms of our parenting and having to be self-reflective about it, but, you know, looking at these issues of implicit bias, but also in terms of our own friendships with the Summers family, who in some ways, you know, they told us the camera in many ways, you know, saved their son in terms of him being able to navigate difficult waters, you know, and having a place to process it with us. And also, it really, by being able to use the camera, allowed us to ask questions to the institutions that were more big picture, that I think forced them to think about things that they may not have had to think about if the camera weren't around. And I think our film in many ways accelerated the process for the school to find constructive solutions to their diversity mission.
That it's not something that is easy, and it's not something we would recommend for every family, but it's made our lives better. And the exciting thing is that it continues to be to give back to us. You know, when we go into theaters in Oakland and in Portland, Los Angeles, Atlanta, we've had amazing experiences with parents who basically see themselves in our actions. They see us as humans making mistakes, and they see the process of recovering from those mistakes. So we think it basically has had the same sort of healing impact on other parents as it's had on us.
It's also really about validating experiences. You know, it's about you know, giving voice to experiences that oftentimes we all think are happening in silos or in isolated moments, but and that's what I think art does. That's what storytelling allows us to do, to make the connections and to understand ultimately that we are not alone in our experiences, and that there are many others going through the same thing, that allows not just for the connection and the validation, but by being able to, by exposing our vulnerability and these experiences and giving voice to these experiences, it's almost like food for being able to continue, you know, to make the changes that need to be made, or in our relationship, or at school, you know, or with our children.
Right. Yeah. Well, thank you both so much for this wonderful conversation, and it's really great, you know, this project and this initiative that you have started with the story of your lives that you're telling, you know, sharing with the community, because you know, it's definitely very necessary, and education is, you know, always looked upon in our community as the way one moves, you know, more successfully through the water. And so, you know, in your commitment to, you know, seeking out the best education possible for your son, you know, as you mentioned earlier, you know, you've given him those tools, and these are tools that all children should have access to. So hopefully with this film, we'll be able to make this possible more immediately and more lasting in the future.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. All right, you take good care.
Thank you, too. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.